All right, so I've watched Hamilton like 50 times since it came out digitally, and if you can't tell that, then you're probably just not paying attention, right? It might become a close second to basketball when it comes to sermon illustrations. So if you've seen it before, you know that one of the most popular songs in the play is called The Room Where It Happens. And that's sung by Aaron Burr when Thomas Jefferson, Alexander Hamilton, and James Madison decide to meet secretly over dinner to discuss a political compromise. So Burr wants in. He wants to be in this room. And throughout the song, he's confined to the outside of this dinner that's happening, narrating what supposedly went down in the meeting. So Lin-Manuel Miranda, who wrote Hamilton, he calls this one of the two best songs he's ever written. And I'm not going to sing it, right? Because it's probably in your heads by now if you've ever heard it. But the text that we're in today is another kind of room where it happens. The room where it happens. It's another room where a huge decision is being made. Probably one of the biggest and darkest decisions in human history. The plot and the plan to murder Jesus. So the event that leads up to this meeting is what we witnessed and talked about last week. Jesus is raising Lazarus from the dead. And Lazarus, he's this close friend of Jesus. He had been dead for 4 days before Jesus shows up at his funeral to grieve and to be with the family. But he also shows up to powerfully and sovereignly call this dead man Lazarus out of the tomb back to life. All to show that he is the resurrection and the life for everyone who believes him and trusts in him. So now, what we see next, this is the aftermath. This is the aftermath of the thing that everyone is now talking about around town. And now we're going to see how the religious leaders who've been opposing Jesus from day one, they're going to collectively and somewhat ironically, right? They're going to try to put to death the dude who's just powerfully dealt with death. So in this passage, we see a situation, this meeting, and then we see a response by Jesus to this meeting. So there are two conclusions that come from this meeting. The first one, someone has to do something. Someone has to do something, verses 45 through 48. The second conclusion, someone has to die, verses 49 through 53. Someone has to do something and someone has to die. And then we'll see Jesus' response to the outcome of this meeting. So first conclusion, someone has to do something. Again, how do we get into this room where it happens? Look at verse 45. Jesus raises Lazarus from death. And as always, whenever it comes to Jesus' signs, right? We see this all throughout the Gospels. People respond in either of two ways. They either believe in him for who he is and what he says, or they persist in unbelief and speculation. Well, in this case, the people who are maybe wrestling and persisting in a little bit of speculation, these people go to the religious authorities. They go to this group called the Pharisees. So why go to them? Well, look, whoever told the Pharisees probably wasn't looking to snitch on Jesus. Maybe they were. But maybe they were looking for further affirmation from the theological professionals. Or maybe in excitement, they took this news to the Pharisees, right? Because this was a group of religious teachers that believed the scriptures teaching about the resurrection. This is what they stood on. And maybe they were going to the Pharisees hoping that this would finally persuade them that this guy, Jesus, he's actually on your side. He believes and affirms the resurrection. He actually raised the dude from death. From their point, their perspective, that's not what happens. The chief priests of the temple and the Pharisees, they gather the highest court of Jewish opinion during this day called the Sanhedrin, which was this group of 70 members of Jewish priests and aristocrats and magistrates, people who won and were victors of games, and they were commissioned by the Romans to govern over all Jewish affairs. And so at the forefront of this council of 70 members, right, was this high priest, this man named Caiaphas. He was a priest, but he was also something like a politician. And so this council, it's made up of the elite, the powerful and the wealthy, the influential. And the purpose of this council was to keep the peace between Rome and the Jewish people, to keep the peace at all costs. And therefore, if anything ever threatens this peace, whether it be civil unrest or the buzz of rural revolutionaries like this man Jesus, then it jeopardizes. It jeopardizes their position. It jeopardizes their power and their influence and their control. Which is why in verse 47, after they've gotten the news that one of the region's rural revolutionaries has done it again, this time the unthinkable, they gathered the council together and they said this: "What are we to do?" More literally, what are we doing? I mean, what are we really doing here? They've been passive and ineffective as Jesus has gone and powerfully performed many signs. And now their power is being jeopardized. Their power and position is being threatened. Jesus has become a real threat to their influence with the community and the people. He's become a threat to the status quo and things as they were. He's become a threat, more importantly, to everything that they worked so hard for, to keep things in line with the Romans. Someone has to do something. This can't go on. And that shows up here in two ways. Look at verse 48. Two ways that if they let him go on like this, then number one, everyone will believe in him. Meaning they're probably not really concerned with where everybody is theologically, but this means that they will lose leadership and influence within the Jewish community, and maybe even abroad. And secondly, the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. Now hear that, our place, our influence, our nation, meaning that they'll lose power outside of the community, and they may even lose the community and the nation altogether. Again, overall, their supreme concern is for their power, their place, their interests, and Jesus jeopardizes that. See, look, it was okay for him to be a small-time prophet out in the wilderness doing signs and doing all kinds of different things, but now he's messing with the power. He's messing with the system, the power structures, their influence, their way of life. Someone has to do something. But for a second, let's just zoom in real quick. Because these are humans just like us, sinful human beings. What is beneath these statements? What's the emotion beneath these statements? It's fear. They're afraid. They're afraid maybe because they can't figure Jesus out. They can't exactly put their finger on him and categorize him. They probably can't wrap their minds around his signs and what he's doing or what he wants. More than anything, they're afraid of the implications of losing their power and their position. They're afraid of losing their freedoms, right? They're afraid of losing the nation and their influence in the community. So look, this sinful fear, it's not confined to just them either. It's not confined to this room where it happens, but it's woven itself, this kind of fear, has woven itself throughout every empire, every system, every government, and every group that is made up of sinful people throughout every era. And let's be honest, brothers and sisters, a lot of this same misprioritization and a lot of this same fear is going around today. We are no different from them. And that's what we want to see as we enter into this room. So listen, we talked about this a few weeks ago. We talked about the perceived political enemies that we identify every 4 years that seem to threaten our ideals, right? The erosion of family values and religious liberty, or ongoing racism and marginalizing the poor and the immigrant. Our perceived threats, the things that are obstacles that will undo the things that we want and hope for. Jesus is this perceived threat, a political and influential enemy. And power is on the line. Jesus is now an obstacle to their power and their freedom. So the question that we can ask ourselves is, who is that for you, brothers and sisters? Who is that obstacle to your power and your freedom? Is it the Democrat? Is it the Republican? The person or the candidate with conservative or progressive ideals? Is it the newest extremist group? Was it this year's protesters outside demanding justice? Who is it that makes us feel that if we let them go on like this, then we'll lose? We'll lose our freedoms. We'll lose our place. We'll lose the status quo. We'll lose our nation. Furthermore, is cultural or political power and even the preservation of our freedoms and our place or our nation, is that our highest priority? And has the fear of losing these things, has it produced within you a power struggle? Listen, brothers and sisters, that is not who we are as followers of Jesus. The gospel tells us that our ultimate hope, our ultimate freedom, our ultimate place is in God. And our politics and freedoms in this world are not in the same hand. But again, if we're honest, then we look around, even in our context. Along the way, we've seen some people intertwine the two. So listen, we can and we should certainly engage in the political arena. We should want to see certain political victories. We should call out immorality. We should speak to the satanic plans and things that we see in society and resist evil. But listen, whether we win or lose when it comes to power, the gospel tells us that our identity is not in that and connected to that. This is who we are as God's people. This is what it means for us to be citizens of God's kingdom. We are good. We are sufficient, no matter who's in power and what's actually taking place. No matter if it looks like we're winning or we're losing. We don't have to be motivated by this kind of fear of losing power. So we see that someone has to do something. And now this progresses to someone has to die. And so this fear doesn't stop at the thoughts of losing our power and our place. It goes much further. It never just stays there, does it? See, much like us, the fear of losing power or the fear of enemies or opponents, it can lead us into sinful responses. The kind of things that we see happening all around us today, right? Fear produces here in this text what we see in the next verses in verse 49 through 50. So in this room where it happens, this council, it's concluded that something needs to be done. But what needs to be done? I mean, what are we going to do? They're asking themselves. Again, we're humans, right? We watch movies. They all know what needs to be done. And nobody even has to say it. But nobody's putting it out there because, well, I mean, have we really come to this? Have we really come to this? This is the moment in this room where you start to see the affirmative looks, the head nods from some while others even refuse to make eye contact. Everybody knows. Everybody knows what the something is that needs to be done. They've all been thinking it as they're wrestling with this struggle for power. Someone has to do something about Jesus. We've got to end him. Now it's Caiaphas. It's Caiaphas who finally speaks up on what needs to be done. Verse 49. You know nothing at all, nor do you understand that it is better for you, that one man should die for the people, not that the whole nation should perish. Look at his frankness. He holds nothing back. This man has to die, plain and simple, full stop, because he is threatening everything of ours, our freedom, our power, and our position. Their fear is leading them to a sinful response. And so for their interest to be preserved and their power protected, Jesus has to be put to death by the system as a criminal and a scapegoat so that the Romans don't come in and take over. They're saying to themselves, we've got to make him an example to show that we've got control. And by elevating themselves through stepping on the dead body of Jesus, What they're going to do is position themselves as a responsible Roman submitted nation that can control its citizens. It is better for us that Jesus die for the nation. And so fear causes them to conspire. And look at this. This is a systemic sin. A group of people in power and influence are now choosing to wield and execute that power against this man, to murder him. They conspire together to murder. Someone has to die. And so that's what this is, brothers and sisters. It is a conspiracy. This is a real political conspiracy to commit murder by an unjust system. And look, right, it's got all the salacious details that we love in these movies and these narratives, right? Here, the rich and the wealthy and the powerfully elite, 70 of them who make up a council that, at least here, echoes of some kind of secret society. They're getting together in this room where it's happening, and they're deciding some really dark things. Maybe they got a secret handshake or something. They run things. They answer to a higher order, and they've got enough individual and structural power and control to maintain society as they choose and see fit. And now here's Jesus, someone who will not be controlled by the system. And now the powerful come together to conspire and murder this man. And jump down to verse 57. They even control the information given to the public. If you see this man, Jesus, arrest him, withholding from them their true plot. It's a real political conspiracy. Not unlike even some of the stuff that we've seen throughout history and even in our context. So listen, brothers and sisters, you and I shouldn't be surprised to see these kinds of things happening in this fallen and broken world. This is what sinful people do. Pick your government, your system, its leaders, or people grappling with power in any human era in history. When it comes to sinful people being gripped by the fear of loss, of power or freedom or influence or things as we know it, that fear will sometimes lead to sinful responses. And in this case, a fear that produces a conspiracy. So look what happens. They're feeling powerless. And they're going to attempt to take back power through doing what exactly? Well, murdering Jesus. But what is this? Dehumanizing Jesus. Ending his life. Seeing him as a thing that must be put down and put away. Now, let's just keep it real to bring it into our context. I mean, if you've been reading the headlines, we actually just witnessed actual people who were planning to kidnap government officials for these same reasons. And although we're probably not going to do anything like that, if we look a little bit deeper, we might still be guilty of a lesser kind of conspiring when it comes to the people that we perceive as obstacles to our power and our freedom. Maybe it's demonizing and dehumanizing them online, in the comment section, through the things that we post, the things that we say behind closed doors or even publicly. Maybe it might be categorizing them, labeling them, or canceling them. Maybe that comes through gossip or slander. Again, people of God, we should not be marked by these things, even in seasons like this, especially amongst each other. Why? Because this undermines the unity that has been achieved for us in the gospel. The real unity, not uniformity, that embraces us as the people of God, redeemed by Christ's blood, even with our differences. Responding in this sinful kind of way undermines that. That's not who we are. That's not who we are. So look, for a second, here's a rabbit trail. Hopefully we'll come back with a rabbit. But I think there's one more way that I think this kind of fear and the fear of loss or power or place causes us to respond in a sinful way. Not necessarily when we're in power, but when we're on the other side of power, when we're feeling like we're powerless. See, we've seen how this fear causes them to conspire, but sometimes the fear of losing power, when we're on the other side, might cause us to believe in and look for conspiring. Again, conspiracy exists in this fallen world, but listen, brothers and sisters, everything isn't conspiracy. See, when we're threatened with the loss of power or place in this world as we know it or want it, sometimes it can be really confusing and overwhelming to wrap our heads around, our finite minds around. Sometimes, right, we look at the demonic nature of things either promoted or pursued in our society, and in order to make sense of it, we're tempted and we're prone to buy into a narrative, some kind of narrative. Help it to make sense. A theory, an unsubstantiated narrative, or something that sounds really good. Or maybe we decide to do that to give ourselves a truth to believe in the midst of so much confusion and deception. Maybe we pursue this kind of thing to motivate ourselves to keep fighting a battle where there's this absolute good and absolute evil. A battle that is marked by flesh and blood, going after people, demonizing and dehumanizing people. And so we buy into these things. Or we buy into them because it gives us control, right? It makes us feel special. It helps us to feel like we've got a secret knowledge about everything that's going on. We really know. And therefore, it produces a kind of security. Or maybe it just pushes away the fear and uncertainty that we feel. Listen, brothers and sisters, I say this to be humorous, but not humorous. There are a lot of people in our country, in other countries, and in their mom's basements targeting us specifically, followers of Jesus, evangelical Christians, even more than others, to believe some of this stuff. But more often than not, believing in these kinds of conspiracies, really it just leads to division and disunity within the church. Within the church and amongst our neighbors. It undermines our credibility as followers of Jesus. It turns love one another on its head. Believing in these things, it demonizes and dehumanizes. It struggles with the loss of power like everybody does. But it addresses that fear with more fear and false confidence. Let's not buy into that stuff, family. We're looking for sure words, for truth. But as the people of God, we have a more sure word. We have a steadfast and enduring, incorruptible truth that is found in God's word. That is this: God wins. God wins. He always wins. And every evil thing that is happening now, everything that we see around us, all of the things promoted or pursued or whatever it may be, will not stop the truth and the power of God's plan and his redemptive purposes. God wins. So listen, I don't know what's actual conspiracy and what's theory. I don't know. The Bible tells us that there are certainly wicked spiritual powers in high places that have demonic agendas that often work through sinful people. It does tell us that there is a God of this world who is actively blinding people's mind to the knowledge and the glory of Jesus and the gospel. But in all this, God is not caught off guard. He is not thrown for a loop, so neither should we. We don't have to be thrown for a loop when we hear about conspiracies, whether true or false. We don't have to live with the fear of loss of power or freedom or place. We don't have to be afraid that evil is ultimately going to prevail. We don't have to be afraid of what we are all fearful of when that happens: death, destruction, loss. Because in Jesus, he offers us something better. Life, eternal, everlasting life. He gives us a kingdom, shalom, the flourishing of this world, the redemption of this world, and a new heavens and a new earth and a new age that this broken and fallen and sinful world is moving towards. Whether it likes it or not, we have something better and more sure. So there's your rabbit. So in the face of wicked conspirators and evil plots, brothers and sisters, God is in control. He's sovereign. And he's not surprised by the conspiring of evil people. As a matter of fact, the Bible teaches that their wicked plans, right? Their wicked plans, carried out however successfully or unsuccessfully, they actually serve to accomplish his. We know Romans 8:28, right? All things are working together for God's people, those who love him, for his eternally redemptive purposes and good plans, and for our good and our joy. We know that. The question is, right? Between knowing and believing, do we believe this? Do we functionally live in this way? The real question is, when you lay your head down on a pillow on the night of November 3rd, and when you wake up on November 4th, will you believe this? No matter who prevails, who's in power, what that means, and the threats that it presents to your freedom, or your power, or your place, or the status quo as you know it. Do you believe this? Will you bank your life on this truth that God wins, God is always working, and he's in control? Just jump down to verse 51 if you need some proof that this is the way things work. Here's a prime example of God's sovereignty, even at work in the mouths of evil conspirators. They're in the room where it happens, right? The room where it happens. But God isn't like Aaron Burr. He's not sitting outside wondering what they're going to do and then trying to figure out what his response is going to be once he figures out the plot and the plan. No, he's in the room where it happens. He's very much so in the room where it happens. Look at verse 51. Caiaphas has just said that it's better for them that Jesus should die for the people, not that the whole nation should perish. But John, he goes on to say this, that he did not say this of his own accord. But being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but also to gather into one the children of God who are scattered abroad. Now, you just read this, right? You read this like I did. That's not prophesying. That's plotting a murder. Look here, the guy who tells his associates that they don't know what they're saying, ironically, actually doesn't know what he's saying. See, directly through their work of conspiring evil, God is actively working at the same time for the good of his people, for your good, and the redemption of this world. Because as John sees it, it is better that Jesus die for the people. Sinful people like us who are gripped by fear, who are gripped by and motivated by trusting in the superficial power of lesser things rather than God. He dies for those kind of people. People like us. And it is better that Jesus die for us than for all of us power seekers. Broken people. It's better that Jesus died for us than for all of us to perish under God's judgment that we deserve for our conspiring, ultimately against God. Maybe I could take you into another room where it happens, where you and I find ourselves on the wrong side of a good God because of our sin and the ways that we reject him. And you and I, in this situation, we are helpless to do anything about our condition. We deserve judgment and justice from him. And someone has to do something. And he will. He will. God did something. And instead of acting and conspiring, oh, this God is good. He acts in compassion and love. Instead of giving us what we deserved and wiping us out and crushing us under his wrath and judgment, God comes into the world. He does something by coming into the world. The word of God, the message of God, the logos of God takes on flesh in the person and work of his son, Jesus. And this Jesus, he lives perfectly when we live imperfectly. He doesn't hang on to power, he serves. He lives perfectly when we lived imperfectly. He fulfills God's requirements of us when we break them flagrantly over and over again. And when someone has to die, it should be us. Jesus dies sacrificially in our place, bearing the penalty for our sin, not just for God's covenant people, Israel, but for his children scattered abroad. And what does that mean, right? All kinds of people made up from every tribe, nation, tongue, and people group. He died to gather us all. With all of our differences, all of our divisions, he dies to make us one. The scattered children of God, to bring them to being one, so that all of us would have unending, everlasting life in him. That's what God is doing in this room where it happens. And that's why you and I can rest in him. We can take what Jesus offers and extends to us, and we can actually have peace amidst the chaos. It's not saying it won't be messy. It's not saying we won't really want to believe some off-the-wall stuff. It's not saying we won't really wrestle and try to grapple with power and wanting to preserve things as we know it. But we have something better. We have a more sure word. So listen, as I close here, I didn't get to spend much time on Jesus' response. But look at what he does when he finds out sort of the knowledge of this plan. Knowing everything that he knows, but maybe just hearing about it on the street. What does he do? Does he amp up his boys and get ready to take it to the Sanhedrin to expose their evil plot? Because he could, right? He could fight back. No, in this moment, he retreats. He goes on and keeps living his life. He no longer walks openly among the Jews. What are you doing, Jesus? This isn't what a politician does. This isn't someone who's looking for power and influence. This isn't what you do. You fight back. You can hear Simon the Zealot, one of his followers, maybe whispering that into his ear. Why are we going to Ephraim? I thought we were going to Jerusalem. He goes into the wilderness to a town called Ephraim. Is this weakness, brothers and sisters? No. Is it rolling over? Is Jesus backing down? Again, on the other hand, is he so set on taking power back through his own means? Does his ministry turn into a Nicolas Cage movie to expose all of his conspirators? Look, I'll stop. This is a man who knows his mission. He is unflinching in the work that God has called him to do and the plan that God has actually accomplished. This is a man who knows his mission, but even more than that, he knows his Father. He's good. No matter what happens, no matter what takes place, even if it means his death, the apparent loss of his power, he's going to go on, he's going to wait for the next steps. Maybe you hear this as a follower of Jesus, even as he says it. Nobody can take his life from him. And nobody can take your life from you. Because he stands behind it. He backs it eternally. Evil will not prevail against him. It will not prevail against all those who believe him and trust in him. But more than that, it's actually serving to work for his ultimate plan. And listen, we can take the same posture. No matter who's in power, or if we lose power or place, whoever's conspiring or might be conspiring against us, we can take the L. We can take the W. But we can be assured more than anything that God's mission won't fail. Because his son moves towards death and deals with death and our sin and all of the evil and brokenness in this world. Do we believe this? but we trust in him. Let me pray for us.